This episode of the Energy Stoners Cafe is sponsored by the Black Arts Matter Network, blackartsmatter.net. Welcome to the Energy Stoners Cafe. My name is Toni Quest, and I'm really happy that you're here. I like to interview the most interesting people I can find on the planet. So grab a cup of coffee, sit down, relax, and listen. You're going to find that these guests are so intriguing, you'll wonder why you didn't know about them before. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Energy Stoners Cafe podcast. I love doing this show, as I always say every week, because I get the most interesting people on the planet to actually talk to me, and I'm very humbled by it. This week, I have someone that I call a woman who is, I say, part of the cool crowd. She is a woman that's a songwriter, she's a flutist, and she's also an author as well. And her name is Sherry Winston, and I'm really pleased to have her on the show. Sherry, this is the second time we've met in 1 week.
Well, Toni, it is absolutely my pleasure, and thank you so much for extending the invitation. I think this is absolutely wonderful.
You are so outstanding on the Zoom podcast that wasn't really a podcast. It's a panel I do periodically called WANS, Women in the Arts and Humanities Network Zoom. And you were outstanding on that. I was listening to some of the things you were saying as I was sitting there and listening to all these wonderful musicians talk. And I realized as I was doing some secret research in the background that you've sung and written, it sounds like, from what I've read, for some really high level, heavy hitting jazz singers, musicians, composers. Tell the audience about how you got into this career and how you became so famous.
Well, I wouldn't call myself famous. I call myself a quote unquote working musician. And just to clear up one thing, the writing that I do primarily is for myself and my own CDs. So I have not reached out. I won't say I haven't reached out because I have, but no one has ever picked up any of my writing to record on their CDs. But it's fine. You know, I think my writing is a little offbeat probably for most people.
How so?
It goes from love songs, which are, I consider, very romantic and sort of mellow. It's something that you could, you know, play with your lover while you're having dinner. But you could also have it in your car after a stressful day or if you're in a traffic jam. You know, it's just like a really mellow writing. One of my CDs is called For Lovers Only. And as a matter of fact, that's the one that comes with my cookbook. And there's nothing that's upbeat in that. The rest of my CDs, I have a total of 6 CDs. The rest of my CDs have a combination of up-tempo, sort of some of the songs are funky. I do covers of people like Stevie Wonder, like Beyoncé, Michael Jackson. So it's not just my original material because being in the record industry for so many years, it really taught me that you've got to outreach to your particular audience. And they may not be ready for your songs, your personal songs. You know, they want to hear something that they already know. And I've noticed if I start a show with Naughty Girl by Beyoncé, you know, the people are like, what? This flute player is playing that? Or if I play Stevie Wonder's Pastime Paradise, which, by the way, I had the opportunity to perform that with him, and I thought I would absolutely die and go to heaven on the spot. But people are really, you know, they stop what they're doing and they turn around because it's not the usual flute repertoire.
But you're definitely performed from the heart. And I did see pictures, and you can do as much name dropping as you like, because I did see pictures of you with Stevie Wonder and others. I vaguely thought I saw you with Gerald Albright.
I actually did a show with him. You're right. You saw him in my newsletter. And we did a show here in Connecticut, and he was very extremely, extremely gracious. And all the people that you see in my newsletter is 6 pages long. It's people that I've played for. In other words, it could have been a big event, or in the case of Misty Copeland, who's the first African-American principal ballerina with the American Ballet Theater. That was a very strange coincidence how that came about. And
I'd love to hear that story.
Oh, okay. Well, with Misty, I was trying to get a ticket for a show that she was doing. It was actually a presentation in Hartford, Connecticut. And I called the number on the flyer and asked the person if I could purchase the ticket. And she says, oh, my God, we're sold out. We sold out like within a couple of hours, so you're late. So she said, what's your name? And when I told her, she started screaming. And I said, girl, what's wrong with you? And she said, oh, my God, I'm a big fan of yours. So I said, really? She says, yeah, I have some of your CDs. So she said, listen, I can't get you in as part of the audience, but how would you like to play for Misty? I said, what?
What?
She said, <"Yeah." laughs> we're going to have a little reception afterwards, and we'd like you to personally play for it. And we'll pay you. So I said, oh, my God, I would be honored. So then she took it back to the committee, and they said, you got Sherry Winston to play? So, you know, this is all, like, news to me. It's like, what are you guys getting so excited about? It's just me. So they said, well, we'd like to see if you could do one other thing. And I said, what's that? Could you interview Misty on stage? And I said, are you kidding? Of course. So they said, well, how can you do both things at once? I said, I'm not going to be playing my flute and interviewing her at the same time. So as long as the two things are separated, there's no reason I can't do it. And I had recently read her biography, so I knew a lot about her. And of course, once I got the job to also interview her, I did extensive research on her. And I became like an avid fan. It was just incredible. So it was such an honor for me to not only have a chance to perform for her, but to actually interview her with my own questions. So that was amazing.
Wow. I hope that they recorded it for you, because that sounds like a once in a lifetime kind of a thing. And it's unusual circumstances to not even be trying to be in the audience, and suddenly you're on stage and suddenly you're interviewing the headliner.
I think that was a God moment. You know, it was just like, I felt like God tapped me on the shoulder and say, okay, this one is for you, because it just came out of nowhere. And the girl was so excited about, you know, the fact that it was me, and I had no way of knowing that she even knew who I was. I didn't assume that she would.
It's like a God wink. I called it a God wink.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I've had some really, really interesting experiences in my life with things, what I call serendipity. And I don't know if I could talk about one more.
Ken, you can talk about whatever you want.
Okay. But this was sort of strange, because I saw a flyer when I was in St. Thomas. I was passing through there. I had just been on a week cruise. It wasn't really a cruise. It was more of a yacht, 75-foot catamaran. And we passed through St. Thomas, and I saw this flyer that was talking about something called the Black Boaters Summit. And I said, what the heck is this? And it said, 7-day ride on a catamaran, you'll be part of the crew. And it was starting right before 9/11. This was before, of course, anybody knew anything about 9/11, but it was the Thursday before what amounted to 9/11. So I happened to have this big gig. It was paying a lot of money. It was a big outdoor concert for one of the big companies. And there's no way I could not do that concert. So I call a guy up that was giving it, and I said, listen, I'm interested. I didn't mention my name or anything, but I said, I'm very interested in going on this boat trip and being part of the crew, you know, traveling around the British Virgin Islands. So he told me the price, and I said, well, I'm not going to be able to get there until Sunday. I'm not going to be able to participate in all the other days. So can you give me a discount? So he says, no, I can't, because my costs are fixed. I said, well, I don't really think that's fair. And, you know, it's a lot of money for me to, you know, have 3 or 4 days that I can't get there. So he says, well, I don't know what to tell you. By the way, what is your name? So again, I told him my name. There's another person. And he said, oh, my God, I know who you are. I love your music. So he says, okay, I have a proposition for you. And I said, okay. He said, how does free sound coming for free? I said, what are you talking about? He said, if you'll play for us like four or five songs twice during the week, you can come on the boat experience for free. All you have to do is buy your airfare. I said, you got it. So I wound up doing that like five times with him. And it was, I have met so many wonderful people through that boating experience. And as a matter of fact, I met the young lady who was an incredible graphic artist out of Chicago. And she's the person that designed my book cover and also my CD, one of my CDs. And now my latest single, she did that. Her name is Pam Rice. And it was just, you know, I could just go through a whole litany of incredible people that I met that have become really close friends from that. So sometimes you just have to put it out there and tell people, you know, gee, I don't think that's fair, or really, you know, say what's on your mind and be honest with people.
Yeah, it's, I think a lot of people have problems with that, like just saying what they really want. Sometimes you have to tell people what you want, you know, before you can get anything. I'm learning that every day. So I'm getting better at it. So it turned out to be a lot more than what you had anticipated. How did you get into initially? I always ask people this question. How did you get into jazz as opposed to any other kind of music? Because jazz is very specialized. Not everybody gets it. I know people that say, I listen to it, I don't understand where the melody is, and they just don't. But then there's everybody else.
So I went to Howard University. I was a performance major in classical music. And during that time, with Howard being a traditionally black college and university, there was a myriad cross-section of students there. And everybody, of course, was into R&B and into jazz. And we had a lot of very well-versed instrumentalists, you know, in all areas. And I really, you know, heard so many talented people that it really inspired me to kind of select that as opposed to being a classical musician. That was my original dream, in an orchestra. I thought that would just be incredible. And I think in my first year at Howard, I started getting into talent shows. And a black audience can be wonderful, but they can hang you up by your toes if you're bad. And they will let you know. I mean, they will boo you off the stage. It's like
Showtime at the Apollo.
Exactly. Exactly. And they are not going to applaud for you unless you are really good. So one of my first experiences, I got one of my fellow students to play keyboard for me. And I walked out on stage with a cape, if you can imagine that. I was trying to be dramatic. And everybody started laughing. They thought it was an absolute riot. And when they saw my flute, they were hooting. So I don't know what they thought I was going to do. There was a classical violinist that played right before me. So they assumed I was going to play classical flute. And it was like, oh, no, we don't want to hear this. Well, we started playing something real funky. And when they heard the beat and they heard the piano comping in the background, the whole audience, they turned and they said, whoa, everybody was screaming. So I started playing and people were literally getting up and clapping. And that was it. I was hooked. I just said, this is what I have to do. I want to get applause for me, not the whole orchestra.
There's something about it. Yes, there is. There's something about it.
Oh, it was wonderful. And, you know, to go from being hissed and laughed at to people embracing me. And then every time after that, every other show that I got in, you know, people were just very supportive. It was like, yeah, girl, play, you know. So it was a wonderful environment. And it really prepared me for the real stage really, really quickly.
So how did you handle this whole situation that we've all been through in the past year with COVID? How has it impacted the work that you do?
Well, I would say within the first week of us really realizing what we had and everything started shutting down, I started fielding calls coming from clients and promoters saying, I am so sorry, but the concert or the event or the special event, whatever it was, is canceled. So I had 13 cancellations, wow. You know, within a week. And what's so sad about that is that I don't have an agent or anyone that helps me. So this was all me getting on the phone, calling people, following up with leads that someone might have told me, so-and-so's, you know, going to give an event, or here's the name of a promoter, and then selling myself to this person. Sometimes as long as 4 or 5 years, I might have to work on this person in terms of sending them things and letting them know my experiences, what I had done in the past, sending them MP3 files and my bio and whatnot. And you know, people usually don't hire you right away. They don't know you. They don't know what you're going to be like on stage. And it was just the repetition of being in touch with people that gets me hired, you know. And then they say, wow, let me listen to this girl's music. She's a big pain in the behind, but let me just check her out.
How did you keep your motivation up?
You know, I've been like this since I was a little kid. And I think that in trying to mentor people, that's the drive and the push is not something that you can teach or give someone. They either have the drive within them to want to do great things or they don't. And you can't make them want it. I have tried to mentor so many people. And usually when I mentor someone, you know, I don't do it for money. I just do it for the love of trying to give back. And I'll say to them, okay, I'm going to give you 5 things that I want you to do before you call me back. And it's simple stuff. Okay, put a list of 12 songs that you might like to perform, either if they're an instrumentalist or a singer, and then put together what musicians you would like to have in your band and give me the names of the instruments. And I might say one more thing to them, you know, as an assignment. Do you know how many people never call me back?
What?
No, they
See,
don't want to do it.
I don't understand things like that. I don't get it.
Well, they tell me, they start off saying, I want a recording contract. So they think by talking to me, I'm going to magically pull a recording contract out of the hat to hand it to them, or I'm going to work on their behalf as a liaison between a record company trying to talk them into signing this person. And that's not what I have to do. I have to explain to people, look, I'm busy trying to promote my own career and survive over here. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to give you the tools, and I will stick with you as long as you do the work. And I will answer any question that you have for me, but you have to do the work. They don't want to do the work.
I wonder what that's about. I don't know if it's laziness or insecurity. Because once you decide you're going to do something, you have to, this way I see it, is that you have to realize that there's always this possibility of rejection hovering over you. And so you have to be really brave to actually put yourself in and do it. Perhaps that's it, when they find out it's just not a 1, 2, 3 done. It's not a slam dunk. You have to do something.
Well, before COVID, part of what I do is give music business seminars on the college level. And occasionally I do it for performing groups. When I performed at the Kennedy Center, they asked me to do it for a few of the professionals for a couple of days when I was there performing. And I love to try to inspire people and help them. But, you know, I start off saying, look, I got 26 rejection letters from record companies. And the first one, I cried when I got it. And then the second one, I just said, they don't know what they're missing, and kept going. And I won't say that I didn't get depressed every time that I got a rejection letter. But after you get about 10 letters, you say, you know what? I can't let these people dissuade me. What am I going to let them end my career before it starts? So I just said, eventually, somebody is going to like what I'm doing and will pick me up as an artist. And that's what happened. You know, you just have to stay with it. You can't expect people to love you unless you're, you know, maybe Wynton Marsalis or somebody right off the bat.
And then maybe not anyway.
Exactly. Exactly.
I think that with artists, the rejection is something that you develop a callus for if you want to survive as an artist that's a working artist.
Well, you have to. And if you don't do that, I don't think you're going to stay in this industry or any industry, you know, whether it's trying to be a fashion model or an actor or a voiceover artist. There are just going to be a lot of people that don't like you, period. It's like being in high school and the mean girls didn't like you and wanted to beat you up after school. So, you know, not everybody is going to love you, and you just have to accept that.
Yeah.
Even with audiences, you know, during the 1996 Olympics, I got to play in Atlanta for a whole month for the Olympic Committee and then various corporations. And my whole band was there, which was absolutely marvelous. You know, you go to a place like that and you might have people in the audience that don't get it. And they sit there and they look at you. You know, they don't applaud. They don't do anything. And the gentleman that hired me hired a specific type of microphone, a wireless microphone that I had never used before. You put it on your flute and it allows you to walk into the audience, which is amazing. And at first I was scared to death because I was used to just standing on stage and playing into a microphone. This meant I had to come off the stage and go and get right in front of people. And I learned that it's an incredible tool because a person who's making a face at you and, you know, they're not enjoying it and they're not getting it, if you walk up to them and you start playing something specifically for them, all of a sudden a smile comes on their face and they start giggling.
Yeah.
And it's like they are thrilled that someone is paying them some attention. And all of a sudden, they love what you do, and they're applauding, they're jumping up and down, they get their girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever to take a picture of you with them, you know.
Oh, there you go. See, then everything changes.
It does change, and you just have to go with people wherever they are. You've got to meet them, and it's not always all about you. You've got to make someone else feel comfortable or make someone feel special. And I just love doing that. I love going out into the audience. And the smiles that come on people's faces are just incredible. Just incredible.
Well, there's something about jazz, you know. I mean, I might have shared with you that I love jazz. It's my favorite, you know, style of music, although I like all music. But I know people that have told me they're music lovers, but they like exactly what they like, you know. And I've had people say to me, not many, because I'm, you know, I usually I hang out with people that like what I like, but I have one woman, she said, I never liked jazz. A couple people, I don't understand it. And I don't understand why people that listen to jazz always have their eyes closed or something like that. And I said, you know, some people just don't quite feel it. I mean, there are styles of jazz that are very simplistic. As you know, I'm not a musician. I'm just talking pretty much as an enthusiast and a former musician. But do you ever find people in your audience, it sounds like you're describing these people, that just don't get it? They don't understand, you know, where it is? Like, how did you know that you had, like, the seed of this? And there's a seed that not everybody has. They can find it, I think, sometimes in fusion music, like maybe Spyro Gyra, which has become more mainstream. And I think generally the general listening public understands how that goes. But when you get to like the hardcore jazz.
Well, see, I'm not a straight ahead player. So with straight ahead jazz, sometimes it's hard for people to follow it. And the improvisation is sort of out there a little bit and they're not getting it. And then, you know, it might hurt their ears or whatever. I'm very fortunate in that I play nothing but melodic stuff. Everything that I play is melodic.
And quite lovely.
Oh, well, thank you. I try to make music soothing, and I've spent a lot of time working on my tone. If you have a bad tone on your instrument, to me, it just turns people off because it's like chalk on a blackboard. You know, it's like screeching or whatever. So as a young person learning flute, I spent so much time listening to Jean-Pierre Rampal and also Hubert Laws, who was my teacher and mentor, listening to their records, James Galloway, mostly classical music musicians at first, just to try to copy their tone. And when you try to copy someone's tone, it improves your embouchure.
Your embouchure? I don't know the word.
Okay. Your embouchure is how you purse your lips to play flute. To me, sound is the most important thing to work on, what you sound like. Because if you're harsh, you've heard saxophonists that have sort of a harsh tone.
Yes.
I've heard trumpet players that actually made me wince, and I try to control my face, but, you know, because you don't want to be obnoxious in the audience, but sometimes it's like, oh, my God, I got to get out of here. This is awful. You know, I heard a guy on a Zoom call, and I had to turn off the sound. That's how bad it was.
Whoa.
But part of Zoom is not complimentary to musicians, so you have to be very careful how you appear on Zoom. You know, you've got to go into a studio or have really good equipment. You just can't pick up your instrument and play it what I call naked on Zoom. You know, not that you're naked, but the sound is naked.
The sound, I know what you meant. It's interesting because you see on TV, especially in the late night shows, you see the bands are in separate places very often, especially during COVID, and they somehow figure out a way to get it together. But I imagine it took a lot of practicing, a lot of technical prowess to make that happen.
You've got to have great technical people. And I've been talking to my keyboard player, Nick Baraluk, who has a beautiful studio. I've recorded some of my work with him. And he put me in touch with a cameraman so that if we were going to do a live Zoom, or what they really like to do is have you play something for them specifically, but then videotape it, so that you can send it to them, because they're really taking a chance if you're trying to play live and hook up with their producers and whatnot on the spot. You know, leave it to Zoom to have something go wrong that would not be good. So far, all the people that I've dealt with Zoom want me to send them a pre-recorded video.
That makes a lot of sense.
You really don't want to take the chance, you know, to find out, oh, my God, there's a glitch there and this sounds bad or whatever. I mean, I was just on a Zoom call for about an hour and a half, and the woman gave an impeccable presentation, and she did sort of a video presentation. But the unfortunate part was there were certain segments of it where the sound didn't come through, and then the picture of her froze. So, I mean, it's just the reality, you know, nothing is perfect on Zoom. You just have to accept that, you know, you're going to have a couple of glitches here and there. And she was very good, like not wincing as all of this was happening, as she was, you know, in a little box. So
it seems that these things are really important now. I'm noticing that performing artists have different ways of dealing with the fact that they're not getting the gigs the same way they used to. Although with the weather getting warmer, even in the north, I really believe things will change a bit. I'm going to ask you, what have you been doing? Like, how are you responding to this, and how has it changed your trajectory, I'll say?
Well, I made up my mind when I left record companies that I was going to conduct my business out of my home office the same way I would conduct myself if I was going into an office, say, at Columbia Records, where I used to work. And that meant getting up early, going to the gym, kind of getting my endorphins going so that I'm tuned up and bright and sharp, and then coming home, having breakfast, and then sitting at my desk, like, all day, basically. And I continued to call my list of former clients, prospects, former people that I had worked with, whether it was private groups, organizations, individual promoters, corporations. And to be honest with you, I would say 90% of the people did not pick the phone up. I didn't really expect them to. But what I would do is leave a pointed message. You know, gee, I'm just calling you to say hello and see how you're doing, mm-hmm. and wondering how you're making out during these challenging times, and just wanted to say, take care of yourself, and I hope all is well. Leave my name and number and move on. So I would do that literally all day long with my list. I must have, this is going to sound real old-fashioned, but I have about 20 Rolodexes. I can pick up cards that I've made out for people, and I can, you know, put them on the side and decide who I'm going to call that day, what corporations, what private groups or whatever. And then I also do promotions. So I'm part of Constant Contact, which is the way to reach like 5,000 people at a time when you send out one email. And then you can pepper it with your music or with videos or with sales of my book or whatever it is that you're trying to do, or letting people know what platforms you're on, you know, whether it's Pandora or Spotify or Amazon, all the different ways that you can sell your music or that they can hear you for free, like Pandora. So I send that out, and I try not to be obnoxious with it. I try not to do one more than one a week, you know, because if you send more, I think, more than one promotion out a week, people start seeing your name and they're just going to basically delete it. It's like, oh, God, not this person again.
Ooh, out.
Don't make people hate seeing your name. That's the worst thing you can do, you know, when you become a pain. And the same thing with calling people. You know, I'll call a client, a former client, and I'm not going to call them, you know, the next day or the next week. I might not call them for another month. I mean, I have so many former clients that I can afford to try to go through my list and not do any duplicates, you know.
You sound like you have your act buttoned up very tightly with regard to your own personal marketing for your music and what you do.
Well, you know what? It would be very easy to get into getting up late, not going into my office, you know, having a pizza for breakfast or whatever, not exercising, gaining 20 to 30 pounds like a lot of people have done, feeling sorry for myself, wanting to jump off the roof. And I know myself, I have to have a plan of what I'm going to do. After I work, I stop like clockwork at 5 o'clock. At 5:05, all of my phones are turned off and I practice. And that's when I do my tuning of my instrument, making sure that I go through all of my classical works. And then I'll put on my iPad and I'll play the tracks. You know, I might do that for 15 or 20 minutes, but I warm up with at least a half hour, if not more, of the classic Bach, Mozart, the different sonatas, exercise books. Because if you call me tomorrow and say, Sherry, you're not going to believe this. I have this great opportunity for you. You know, can you be at XYZ Friday? I can say yes and know that I'm going to kill it. Not that, oh my God, I haven't practiced in 3 weeks.
Yeah, you're all ready for it.
I'm ready. Because with the flute, and I'm sure that there are other instruments like this, it's not a forgiving mistress. It wants your undivided attention. And if you put it down for more than a few days, when you pick it up, it's going to sound like a tin whistle. Your lips start to get slack. They're not taut.
How about your breathing?
The breathing, well, I do a lot of exercise, so the breathing, I wouldn't have a problem with that. But when I was on vacation one time, you know, I was supposed to perform in Barbados like the next week, the first week. I didn't have anything that I had to do. So I was just, you know, at the beach. I was hanging out. I was having a good time. And I said, I don't feel like practicing. The heck with this. I'm on vacation. So 2 days before this concert that I was going to give, I picked up the flute. And the flute said, ah-ha-ha, I've got you. Wait to see what I have in store for you. And I played my first note. And what came out was...
Oh,
it was awful. And I said, okay, let me tighten up my lip. And it sounded bad for hours. Do you hear what I'm saying? And I've been playing since I'm a little girl.
Yeah, you just had to warm up a little bit, you know?
I had to continue to warm up. And the lip, what I didn't realize, my lips had gotten sunburned.
Oh.
Even though I had suntan lotion on everything, the lips still got sunburned and they were like leather. So your lips can't be like leather. They have to be very pliable and soft in order for the air to come over your lips properly to make the proper sound. And girl, I got so scared because I said, oh my God, I cannot get on stage and sound like this. So then I had to spend hours trying to get my lip together. And right before the show, I really wasn't sure what was going to come out. And I said, I will never, ever do this in my life, ever. It just scared me to death.
You have to definitely get the practice in every day.
You have to. You really have to. And even if it's just for a half hour, it's just tuning the lip up and keeping it in good shape.
So it's the true what they say, if you don't use it, you lose it.
Well, in the case of the flute, it is true. And I'm sure, you know, like if you're playing piano or violin, maybe your technique wouldn't be as fast or...
No, I can tell you, I played the piano and violin, and I haven't played, and when I get in front of a piano or violin, it's like I completely forgot. I don't know what to do. It's the truth.
Really?
Yes. Yeah,
for not,
because I don't have a piano, you know, but I'm just saying that I know what you're saying about the practice. You do have to tool your chop, as they say. I think you have to do it in a lot of arts. I have to do it with my own visual art.
You're a visual artist?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Awesome.
And so if I don't do it, I get a little rusty.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly, I find it's good to walk away from the art for even if it's for a few hours and come back and then you see it differently. But I digress because this is about you and the flute, not about me and my occasional slacking off on what I know I should be doing. But I just want to ask you, when you first started playing the flute, you know, I'll ask you how old you were. Did you find that it came naturally to want to do it? And so you were able to just sort of get into it? Because sometimes I've seen this with people as an educator. I've seen there are certain people that can do certain things that they've never done, pick it up and boom, they're just doing it. I always wondered that about musicians, real musicians, not one like me, a real one.
Well, I'm not little Stevie Wonder, so... When I first picked up flute, I couldn't even get a sound out of it, and I was absolutely horrible. I started at age 11 in junior high school, and all the other kids were getting a sound on the flute, and I don't know what happened, but I just couldn't get the sound. So, you know, after a couple of days of total frustration, I went to the teacher, and I said, could I take my flute home and practice it? And she was, like, stunned. It was like, what? You know, nobody wants to practice at home. And I took the flute home. I took the headpiece off so you have less air, you know, to try to get through the whole flute, and tried to get my lips in the proper position to get a sound out of it. So once I could get a sound out of it every time I tried to play it, then I added the rest of the body. And I was just, applauder. I'm not going to be the worst one in the class. That's not going to be my position. I cannot do that.
There you go, you know?
Yeah, I would say after a few months, you know, I started like probably being the best one in the class. So it didn't come naturally, though. I really had to work at it.
So I guess is it a genetic thing? Often with people that are in the arts, there's always a relative that's also an artist or artistic or creative or a musician.
Well, my dad was a professional musician, so, you know, I heard music all of my life, and he also had a regular, quote-unquote, day job. So he and my mom were in USO together. He had talked her into going to USO, and being in his band, he was, like, in one of these big bands. So I heard music all my life, and then my brother studied classical piano, and he still plays now, you know, to this day. He has a Steinway in his house. But I think that I've exceeded probably a little bit more than my dad, because he always had a day job. You know, he wasn't able to earn his living playing music.
But you were.
Well, it took, you know, I had day jobs for a long time, and I worked for many record companies, and I did social work. So I paid my dues in terms of suffering and not being able to really perform, you know, full time. And I had my days of leaving my office and changing in the bathroom because I had a gig someplace, you know, and then getting there. And I've got stories for days, girl. But
we can have you on again. And you can tell them to me. I'd love to hear. So I just have some questions to ask because, you know, we're getting close to the end. Two questions. One is the most important one is, how can someone get in touch with you? Website, email, phone?
They can do all of the above. They can go to my website, sherrywinston.com, S-H-E-R-R-Y, Winston, like the cigarette, .com. They can also email me, the same spelling, Sherry Winston Band, B-A-N-D, at Gmail. And if they send me an email with their phone number, I'll be happy, more than happy, to call them and give them my phone number.
Okay, and then my last question, but not forever, because we will talk again, Sherry. But the question I have to ask you to tell the audience is, how can they buy your book?
Well, they can go online at my website, and you can order it there. The other way, if you have problems, some people are not great with the new technology of, you know, or they might not want to put their credit card, you know, into PayPal, because I have PayPal. They can just reach out to me by email, send me their phone number. I will call you, and I have a square, so they can order it right over the phone.
That's great.
And the other way, if they want to write a check and they don't want to put it on their credit card at all, I can give them a post office box that they can send it to. So, you know, every which way they can get to me. I'm not a difficult person to reach at all.
You do avail yourself, and that's what we need to do as artists. We need to avail ourselves, you know, probably more than most. Well, I'm going to thank you so much. You know, Sherry, you know, you're unbelievable. And I have to say that I'm really glad that I met you, and thank you again for coming to the Wands panel, because, and you were so like persistent. You got in there. I had faith. I said, no, I was in the middle of the thing, and I'll tell the audience, I had a little technical difficulty with getting you on the visual, but you came in an audio, and I listened to a little bit of it, and you really have an outstanding story to tell, and I know that there's more.
Thank you, Tony. I appreciate that, and I really appreciate your outreach, you know, and saying that maybe I would have something to say.
Oh, absolutely. I knew you did. I knew you did. I knew it. And I'm going to tell the audience to definitely go to your website. Your website again is?
SherryWinston.com.
So go there, you know, be there. My father would say, be there or be square. I'm serious. Got to get some Sherry music in your blood here. And I'm going to invite you to come back and talk to the audience again. We're sort of doing a little bit of talk with people about COVID. And so we've gone through every stage with the Energy Stoners Cafe and interviewed a lot of different people. And maybe when things open up, if you're willing, you could come into the studio and do a talk with TQ.
That would be wonderful.
I'd love that. Thanks so much for coming on. I appreciate it a lot.
You're welcome, and take care of yourself.
You too. Okay, everybody, goodbye. Come back next time. Next week, I'll have someone else good for you to listen to. I promise, I promise, I promise. And be well, be nice, stay safe, and I'll say bye-bye. Thank you for listening to the Energy Stoners Cafe.